T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
12 voices in 12 hours. This is a special community discussion on school safety and gun violence in America on News Radio 930 WBEN.
Good morning, everybody. It is a Beach and Company, and I'm Sandy B. 12 voices, 12 hours. Before we start the show officially, Joe, I want you to guess which one of the two men in the studio is the FBI agent. Could you give it a shot? Give it a try.
It's a tough one.
The guy who looks like a solid block of granite, or me? I mean, let's guess. Actually, his name is Kevin Lyons. He's the acting special agent in charge of the FBI in Buffalo. And welcome to the show, Kevin.
Morning, Sandy. Thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure.
Now, I will... Not yet. You don't know. It's not 10 o'clock yet. But I know you already know this, but I think I should tell you, you have a right to remain silent. Now, the first thing we want to know is that we know the FBI basically by what we see in movies and TV shows and things like that. But it covers a lot of ground and has a lot of authority. And I thought we'd kind of open up and see how the process works. For instance, would you consider the FBI a proactive or a reactive agency?
Both, proactive and reactive. We react to national disasters, critical incidences, but also proactive and reactive regarding gang investigations, violent crime incidences, counterterrorism investigations.
I was going to ask you about that. Regarding gangs specifically and maybe schools, does the FBI have a program where you send in undercover people if there's a need for that, or is that somebody else that would have to do that?
Yes, for organized crime investigations. Yeah. I mean, all investigations that we cover, we would use the undercover technique as one of our sophisticated options that during investigation.
Now, say there's an active shooter in a school situation. How does the FBI get involved with that? Are you invited in by the local authorities? Do you just go in as a matter of course because you have the authority to do it? How do you proceed with something like that?
So if there was an active shooter incident here in Buffalo, we would respond immediately. I would coordinate with the commissioner or chief of police in that town and say, what assistance do they need from the FBI? Everything that we have in our toolbox here within this division or across the country, we would provide to that police department.
I assume that you have the biggest toolbox at the shop. One would think, and I wrote down some things that I wondered if you used during the investigation and during the process of the actor shooter drill. Negotiators, SWAT teams, special weapons, jurisdictional, make sure that the jurisdictional command is proper. What tools do you bring that the local authorities may not have? Or do you have anything that they don't have?
Well, all those tools that you just mentioned, and usually these active shooter investigations or incidences happening in small, medium-sized cities where the police departments rely on other law enforcement agencies in that area to help them. So you have that, and not only does the Bureau have that here within their field office, but we can bring entities from across the country, such as our HRT program, victim assistance people or things like that to help that local community with that tragic incident or that law enforcement agency deal with it.
You know, as tragedies happen, we learn more. We're more educated. I assumed before 9/11, and I don't know why I assumed it, that all of the agencies shared information, that if you had it, ATF would have it, state police, everybody would have it. And then we found out 9/11 that wasn't necessarily the case, and I think the president tried to open up the lines of communications. Would you say that the lines are pretty open now, that you can go across agencies and get the information you need to take care of your job?
Absolutely. Probably pre-9/11, a lot of the issues was technology-based, and I think that a lot of those fixes have occurred. It lets us share information across the board with everyone. including other things such as working groups, task forces. We're able to trade and share information with all our law enforcement partners or intelligence community partners across the globe.
Now, what about training? I assume, and see, I'm making some assumptions now. I assume that the FBI is very highly trained and highly skilled and may have the wherewithal more than some locals as far as the money is concerned to have the ability to do all these things. What about the fact that you have to work with the other agencies, and now the shooter's been apprehended, that's done, and now the investigative part starts. Does that automatically go to you, or does it go to local agencies?
No, those violent crime, active shooter instances are local matters. The FBI is purely there to assist in whatever that police department or local community would need to help them either solve the problem,
right?
Assist the community in, say, victim assistance situations, or just help with the investigation in general. It could be evidence response teams just to help them that they don't have those techniques available.
Is there any? I wanted this question to sound proper. Is there any ego involved with the various agencies all at the same place at the same time moving forward? Or have we gotten to the point where those are put aside? We know that at the top, politically, there's always conflict, but I didn't know at the actual scene and the post-scene if everything went pretty smoothly. Do you have normal, regular conversations with the locals, or does it only come up when an event comes up?
Yeah, that occurs every day. And those type of things you're talking about are situations you see in movies and TV shows.
Right.
Like I said, we have every field office has a number of task forces where most of the police departments are on those task forces sharing information. We have executive committees where we're sharing. We're bringing the chiefs of police and the commanders, and we're sharing. Could be counterterrorism matters, violent crime instances, or gang cases, public corruption cases, where we're sharing information on a regular basis.
All right, we'll take a break. We are live with Kevin Lyons. He's the acting special, very special. Have you seen this guy? He's very special. Agent in charge of the FBI. We'll be right back after this. We have Special Agent Kevin Lyons, who is the acting special agent in charge of Buffalo FBI office. One of the questions that we have on our tech screen is, is there a difference between a special agent and a regular agent? Is that a promotion? What is it? Title?
Special agent and agent, exact same thing.
Same
just
thing.
Just a shortened version.
All right, good. Now, here's a question I want to ask you. I don't want this to be political, and if you think it is, feel free not to answer it. But certain things that I'm thinking that the greatest problem we have when we have a discussion on guns is ignorance. People who know nothing about guns start commenting about guns and whatever. And for somebody who's in the field, first of all, I'm sure you take an oath of office to uphold the law and the Constitution and whatever. Are there times when, as a law enforcement agency, you wish that you either had more law, less law, whatever, or do you operate within the parameters of what we have and that guides you on a daily basis?
Yes, that's exactly right. We work within the parameters that we have. On a daily basis, cases like investigations, we arrest gang members, bank robbers, counterterrorism subjects where we know they're going to be armed, and we take great precautions in when we're arresting those type of people. But also just in violent crime against children cases, which were, you know, across the board, you know, members of society who could be teachers, lawyers, law enforcement officers, white collar crime type cases where they're not violent. Those are the people where end up using weapons either to kill themselves or against law enforcement where we're trying to arrest them.
There's the concept of a gun-free zone. I view it as an absolute a sign that you shouldn't have that sign on your lawn, gun-free zone. I think it attracts people rather than keeps them away. Does that have any impact with you? Do you think a sign in somebody's house or business that says gun-free zone is beneficial, or is it difficult to justify it?
Yeah, we treat everything the same, so it wouldn't matter if that was a gun-free zone was there. Now, we assume Everyone is armed every time we approach someone.
I think that's the right way to do it, too. You have my permission to think about that. The concept of a permit, a pistol permit, a carry permit, say, in New York State, according to the terms of the New York Safe Act, are there many crimes committed? And to the best of your knowledge, obviously I don't expect exact numbers. Many crimes committed with people who have a pistol permit using the pistol that's on their permit. Because my understanding, I've not seen any formal polls on this, but my understanding is probably not many. If you go through the effort of getting a New York State carry pistol permit, you're probably not going to be the bad guy.
I'm not sure if I'm educated enough to answer that question on that.
Okay.
I know that cases that we have arrested subjects or violent crime type incidents we saw with permit or without permit.
Okay. Now, regarding crimes committed by permit holders, which we just talked about, what about preventing that by being proactive? That's the first question I asked you. If somebody turns in a tip that we think so-and-so could be dangerous, they're planning something, whatever, what would be the next step? If the FBI got that complaint and decided this is a legitimate complaint, we should investigate it, what would you do next?
First thing is we would open an assessment on that case to kind of see preliminary techniques that we could use to see if that threat is real. We could coordinate with local law enforcement and just get to the bottom of the threat and see, is it something that needs more follow-up on, or is it just kind of a hoax?
Yeah, because I can't imagine with the numbers of people that would try and say, I think something might happen, this could happen, differentiating between a real threat and a perceived threat, it's going to be tough for you. You've got to make decisions. You don't have enough people there. You probably would never have enough people to investigate every single threat. So you've got to have your own parameters of what is serious and what isn't.
Absolutely. So I think last year, the number of phone threats that came into the Bureau is about 760,000.
Whoa.
And that's not, and then around the same number for email threats. So it's a balancing act. You'd say 9 out of 10 are probably not real.
Wow, and you've got to make those decisions every day.
Absolutely.
Now, who would make that decision? Suppose it was a local threat that was deemed a viable threat. Would you, as the agent in charge of the FBI office, would you make the decision? Do you have a team? Who makes the final decision of, yes, this is serious, or no, this probably isn't?
So, for example, a threat would come in. We have a violent crime squad. A supervisor would assign that to an agent or a task force officer. They would work that investigation, and then either it was something that they'd expand on or end, then the supervisor would either approve the closing of that or continue the investigation.
So that's quite a process.
Yes.
It's not a casual process. So when you're investigating, you're pretty sure there's something to investigate.
Absolutely. And here just in Buffalo, we actually take it a step further where the supervisor either close or continue that case. And then the executive management of the field office, the our assistant special agent in charge, and myself, we meet every morning at 9 o'clock, and we just kind of go through those cases and see where all the T's crossed, all the I's dotted, and should we continue that or end it in that case?
Of course, communication now, especially among younger people, is very much online. How much normal investigation involves online surveillance? In other words, say Joe Schmo was deemed to be problematic. Would you go and check his Facebook page? Do you need a special warrant for anything like that? Or how does that proceed?
A threat comes in. We open an investigation. Investigation authorizes us to use certain techniques, and one of them was to review that person's social media. Facebook, Instagram, and not text messages. That would then require another level, subpoena, to get to the phone company to get those text messages. So there's different phases. We have a threat assessment. We can kind of use basic techniques. And if we saw the case was going to advance, we would then open a preliminary investigation. We then use more techniques per the Attorney General guidelines, which gives us more power then to look into that person's background.
Does the attorney, the U.S. attorney, have to authorize any form of the investigation that you're involved with? Or, as you said, the preliminary parts are quite clear. But as you get further along, does the U.S. attorney have to authorize and then a judge sign off on it?
Absolutely. So the right when we have a case, we would coordinate with the U.S. attorney's office with an assistant U.S. attorney. That would be the attorney sponsoring that investigation. And then if we needed techniques, so subpoenas, warrants, we would have to go through a federal judge to sign off on that.
Are judges usually pretty amenable to that? I assume you have your act together when you present the information you need to present to get what you need from the judge. Are they pretty agreeable, or is it really a tough sell?
It goes back and forth. We have to provide enough information for that judge to see that that person is a serious threat to the community.
We've heard that, they came in with a warrant, so that allows you to go in and do basically what you want to do. You've kind of outlined the steps of getting involved. Now let's talk about getting uninvolved. How do you make the decision that we've investigated, this is not a serious threat now that we've investigated, and who can sign off on that? The same team that signed on, or any individual say, we're done with this investigation?
Yeah, so the agents, the task force officers, the analysts, the other professional staff in the office that's working that case, when it got to the point where they saw they've conducted all the techniques that they can do, and they said, yes, this is not an investigation worthy to continue, the supervisor then would approve the closing of that investigation.
So it's pretty documented. Getting in and getting out is a pretty documented process. It's not casual.
Absolutely.
And the big discussion now, certainly in media, probably in social media too, is about guns. It's not a new discussion. It's a discussion that continues. Of course, as we said earlier, the FBI, as all law enforcement agencies do, take an oath of office to enforce the laws and stand by the Constitution or whatever. So you have your guideposts right there. But now everybody is jumping in, every politician's jumping in, and every talk show host, whatever, talking about guns. Do you think that in a perfect world, as law enforcement, would you think that if we had no guns with private ownership, the crime would just dissolve, go away?
I don't know if I really comment on that, like the politics behind that, but like I said, we assume that everyone has guns that we approach, and every agent, if it's for an interview, every time we knock on someone's door or we're conducting arrests, everyone is armed that we're approaching.
Well, nothing personal, but you're the last person I would want to see knocking on my door. You got it? I'd rather buy Girl Scout cookies. I could even sign up for a subscription to a magazine. I don't want to see you at my door. How do people react on a beginning of an investigation when you show them the badge, FBI? Do they have a knee-jerk reaction of, oh, really? Do they get nervous? Are they comfortable? I mean, just a general thought.
I would say yes, most people. When I was an agent in the New York City office back in the 90s, every time you knocked on that door was probably the first time they met an FBI agent.
Wow.
So it's always that shock. What did they do or what's going on? And it was probably the first time they ever dealt with somebody in the FBI.
Yeah, let's keep it that way, too. Hopefully. We'll be back with Kevin Lyons. He's the acting special agent in Chicago. Nice guy. If he wasn't on duty, he could knock on your door and you'd welcome him in for coffee. But if he's actually bringing his badge and his sidearm, maybe not. We'll be back with more on the 12 Voices in 12 Hours on News Radio 930 WBEN. Thank you, voiceover lady. We're back with Kevin Lyons. He's the acting special agent in charge of the FBI here in Buffalo. One of the things that saddens me, I think, is a lack of progress in how to protect the kids in school. This is one of the main sources of conversations now. I refuse to believe that the best advice we have at this point is for them to be hiding in closets and hope that nobody, especially the shooter, nobody hears them. There have to be advancements in this, and yet a lot of it's political. Does the FBI have a set of guidelines? If a superintendent of school came and knocked on your door and said, we want to protect our kids as best we can, using the existing law, what would your recommendations be to them?
Probably just like we use with banks and other private businesses, as far as reinforced doors, windows, how to teach the children where to go, always be prepared if something does happen, how to respond to that. You know, for example, when you go through the FBI Academy, and I'm sure the same is with all law enforcement agencies, you always walk into a situation. It could be a 7-Eleven, a restaurant, church, where you're looking around your surroundings always, if this happened, what would I do? So I think that we have to prepare everyone how to think like that.
Awareness. Awareness is so important. I learned some awareness when I had a motorcycle. You better be aware of who's around you. If this person stops suddenly, where are you going to go and whatever? But it seems, especially in the movies, I know you're not a movie critic, they do the dumbest thing. They're not aware of anything. The woman going out to the car does not have her car keys in her hand. They're in her purse, which has everything in there, and she has to dig for them. People are not aware of, wow, that light wasn't on when I left. How come it's on now? How do we teach more awareness of your surroundings? I mean, basically, it's easy to say, not easy to do. Some people assume nothing bad's ever going to happen to them, and so they kind of walk around in a fog. When indeed, being a talk show host, believe me, we're aware of our surroundings. So how do you teach that?
I think it's education.
Yeah, it has
I
to
think
be.
Businesses, offices, academia, they have to teach and educate the people that work there, the students, on how to be aware. And that constant education of that, I believe, is the only way to get around it.
When you mentioned earlier you were an agent in New York City, I assume that that is a very, very active place to be an agent, and especially with gang warfare and gang crime and whatever. What was it like working in that kind of an atmosphere like New York City?
New York was a great office to work in. I was on one of the five La Cosa Nostra squads in New York. I was on the Colombo family squad, and that was, again, New York has everything. Gangs, organized crime, white-collar crime. And it was just a great, great city to work in, great office.
Well, the FBI has a tradition and a grand tradition, certainly if you go back in time to the beginnings of the FBI, for dealing with exactly what you just said, with the various families and whatever, putting a lot of people undercover, putting a lot of people in jail. And without the FBI, I don't know where we would be in New York City right now. So New York would be a coveted position if you were an agent and you had a choice of working in various field offices?
No, New York is just like every one of our 56 field offices across the country.
Is it really?
It's just there's more. There's more agents. There's more staff there. But here in Buffalo, they have the same thing that New York City has. New York City is just probably bigger as far as if you're looking at white-collar crime-type threats or public corruption, the money is more. Same with organized crime or gangs, just more people, more activity involved. But the same activity, the same crime problems are across all 56 field offices in the United States.
The first question I asked you is whether the agency is proactive or reactive, and you said both, and that's what I expected. But on the proactive side, we also talked about part of that with getting warrants and whatever. Let's talk about lay people. Does the FBI speak to groups that invite you in to speak about law enforcement and whatever? Do you get out there? Do you have information available to the general public? Because the FBI is a pretty elite unit, and I assume a lot of people want to know how you work and want to know what you do works in the real world.
Absolutely. One of the programs we have kind of opened the curtain. Yeah. On that mystery is our Citizens Academies. We bring people from all walks of life into our office for a number of weeks and get to hear what we're all about and see who we are. They get to shoot firearms. They get to talk to a number of different people in the office. So they just kind of see like we're a next-door neighbor. Also, we have people involved in campus liaison agents. We have people that go out to the private sector on a number of occasions to talk to them how to help them with the issues they have in their businesses.
Well, see, that's ideal because, as I said earlier, the biggest problem we have is communicating our ideas and whatever is ignorance. And if the FBI goes out and kind of explains some of the things you do and explains how you do them, within reason, that I think it's very, very helpful for the average person to suddenly have a feeling that they know more about what the FBI does. And I'm sure that's very beneficial to you.
Absolutely. And that having that group of people involved in those programs to get to see what we do, it's just very successful information that we get on a daily basis.
Yeah, if somebody was interested in being a law enforcement officer, is the FBI something you could directly apply to, or do you have to go through the channels of local police and then maybe state police and work your way up like that?
So to be an FBI agent, you can be from all walks of life. Historically, in the past, when I came through, it was usually accountants, attorneys, law enforcement officers, military. Now, with the number of crime problems that have come up in the past few years, such as cyber crime, so we're looking at agents with computer backgrounds, foreign language abilities, engineering degrees because of the change of technology. So I say we kind of, not necessarily you don't need a law enforcement background to be an FBI agent. We will teach you that when you go through the academy and come out as a new agent to whatever field office you land in.
I love the fact that you're talking about online and needing specialists for that. There's a group of people out there. They're committing crimes. They're not pulling a gun or a knife, and they're not stealing your jewelry, but they're stealing your identity. They're stealing your money through internet fraud and whatever. How involved is the FBI in that specifically? Do you have people that are constantly searching the internet? Do you work off of tips like you would on a shooter? How does that kind of FBI work different from going out and getting the bad guys directly?
So, for example, in bank robbery investigations, we still do bank robbery cases where someone goes up to hold up a bank and they could steal, a few thousand dollars. But now you could have that person sitting in their basement in Russia and could steal millions of dollars from Bank of America in a matter of 30 seconds. And that's the difference now. So we need agents and professional staff, personnel, and analysts to know how to work those type of cases to target those individuals.
You know, it'd be great if you were hiring for the FBI and you were looking for the specialist that could unlock the internet. I don't know what their final exam would be like, but it'd be fun giving them a challenge. Here's something. If you can unlock this, we can talk further. That had to be cool.
Absolutely.
Do all the agents have to take that kind of training because it's the way people communicate nowadays, or does it all funnel down to the specialists in that, in your department?
So, for example, when I came through in the 90s, 96, you didn't have that. But computer wasn't really a big issue then. So you kind of learned. I learned on the job. Now there's people coming in that they're probably 30, 31 years old, and they've worked. They've had that educational background. Sure. Plus, they've worked in that field for a number of years. So they're coming into the Bureau with that background and able to right away investigate those type of cases.
When the FBI first started, they've always valued, as best I know, education. Wasn't one of the requirements then, and it may still be, that you're a college graduate?
Absolutely.
So yep. That's that you're starting off with a very high level of expertise then.
Yes.
People who are educated. Good.
Usually it's initially a four-year degree plus a number of years of work experience. The average agent that's in Quantico is probably anywhere from 28 to 31 years of age.
We'll be back with more. Kevin Lyons is with us. He's the acting special agent in Buffalo, in charge of the Buffalo office. Back after this. It is Beach & Company. A program note, do you know a veteran who deserves a night out? Enter our Nominate a Veteran contest on WBEN.com for a chance to win a pair of tickets to a Sabres game in the Veins Sabre Suite. It's hard to miss that one. Along with David Bellavia, a decorated war hero. Contest ends on March 9th. This is the 12 hours. That's correct. 12 hours, 12 voices, hearing different people talking about various aspects of the things we talk about every single day. And the acting special agent in charge of the FBI office, Kevin Lyons, is with us. How much does and where do the lines of differentiation show up between, say, your agency and the ATF?
Well, we work very close together. A lot of the jurisdictional priorities that we have are the same. So it could be gang investigations, violent crime cases, gun cases. We would work together and collaborate. And it wouldn't matter if one wanted to take the lead over the other. We would partner and make sure that we resolved that issue at hand.
So if somebody was selling guns illegally on the street and you thought you had a pretty good handle on it, would you go in and do it yourself, or would you hand it to them, or would it be a joint effort?
We would coordinate with the ATF, and if it was a situation that they didn't know anything about, we would bring them along with us to help us either conduct a search warrant or interviews and so on in that case. It was another area, say they were involved already, we would see what we had, what they had, and just see who had the best case at hand and take the lead on it.
Well, one of the things that everybody seems to agree on, that one of the problems in Western New York, especially with Buffalo, are guns, illegal guns, being brought in from other states and sold on the street here. Is something like that a problem for your office, or is it more in another's jurisdiction?
That's all over the country, and it's a problem because, it, like I mentioned, that just agents approaching individuals on the normal everyday business that they do, is that person armed? So a lot of illegal guns are out there, either gang members or just an everyday citizen out there, and how they're going to react to a law enforcement officer approaching them.
Well, you know, we had a call a few days ago from a listener, and we were talking about making the schools safer. And the listener was, I mean, right on with one sentence: pay the price. And the price is in dollars. Is it the same? Is it part of your mindset to say that if we're willing to pay the price, we can have enough people where they have to be, we can train them to the level that we have to train them, and suddenly things are going to be a lot safer, but it's not going to be inexpensive. It's going to cost some money. Do you believe that most of the time money doesn't always solve the problem, but do you think money would be helpful here if you had access to the checkbook you needed?
Absolutely. Everything, training especially, the money for that would be a huge enhancement, and it would help solve the problem. I don't really the politics evolve around the money situation, but everything is about the dollar these days. And after 9/11, you saw that they did put the money into the security at the airports and handling that issue. So It is a big part of taking care of that crime problem.
After 9/11, I think 9/11 was a turning point for us knowing and learning about interagency cooperation, things like that. But one of the things George Bush said was, in a national address, we're going to have to deal with people that we don't particularly like and people we normally don't like to deal with in order to find out about 9/11. And the FBI, I assume, would be the agency that has to deal with maybe some people we don't particularly like to get inside information on your various investigations. Do you have to do much of that?
Absolutely. That goes on a daily basis.
How scary would it be to be undercover? Well, probably if you're an FBI agent, nothing scary. But for me, just average talk show host, how scary would it be to be undercover thinking, what if I made? What if somebody knows who I am?
So I've never been an undercover agent or been involved in that program, but I know they are well-trained, have a number of years' experience in different investigations, and it is. Sometimes they are put into scary situations.
How could you work undercover? You're 6'1,000. There's no way you can hide yourself. Or, hey, look, this average guy just showed up at our meeting. Who knew about that? When you have those kind of assignments, say you want to put an agent someplace in Buffalo undercover, and it's going to be deep cover. It might be under for a while. Is that strictly voluntary, or do you assign people to do stuff like that?
So we have a number of undercover agents throughout the country. We would canvass for that to see who would want to come in and do that. And then we have policies and procedures when they are undercover to take care of them and make sure they're out of that particular situation for a while to make sure mentally and physically they're okay.
Do you have a section that monitors your own, the FBI department, to make sure everything is where it should be?
Absolutely. There's a whole section at FBI headquarters that monitors our whole undercover program.
Now, the assumption is that the FBI is the elite agency. What don't you have right now that you would think would be helpful, that you would like to have? Now, I don't know if we'll get an appropriation from any politician listening, but usually if you have the right tools to get the job done, you're okay. But maybe there's something you've been wanting as an agency, maybe nationally, that you don't have yet that you would like to see FBI get into.
I see more just nationally. You hear about congressional approval for different techniques that we're able to do to catch the bad guys. And if you take that away from the FBI, so for example, wiretaps and different sophisticated techniques that we need to do our job, if you take those away from us, it would be very difficult.
Okay, now watch out how you answer this question. This is the toughest question I'm throwing at you all day. What about women in the FBI? Be careful now. They've been in the FBI for a long time. Are a lot of women anxious to join the FBI?
Absolutely. There's a number of female agents that cover all programs across the country in the FBI. Here in Buffalo, they're on every squad. Doesn't matter if it's the Safe Streets Task Force, the Crimes Against Children Task Force, the White Collar Squad, the Counterterrorism Squad, across all different programs. And the FBI is a very strong recruitment process where we're bringing in recruiting female agents from across the country, all walks of life.
And how many military people, do you get people when they got out of the military, maybe they were in some kind of enforcement in the military and they get out and they're already partially trained, maybe? Do you get a high interest from military to join the FBI?
Absolutely. There's a number of agents who are former military, either through the military academies or from the military itself.
All right. I'm telling you, it's fascinating because, as I said, we normally learn through movies, which can be woefully deceptive about how any agency works. But the FBI has always been held as a very elite agency. Do you have any specifics on how long you're allowed to stay in one office before you're generally moved? Or if you like a community, you stay in there as long as you want. How does that work?
So a number of things have changed throughout the years as far as policies. A number of years ago, if you're in a small, medium-sized office, say like Buffalo, and you just came out of the academy, you would do about 3 to 5 years and then sent to a big office. They changed that policy recently. So you could stay. If you didn't want to advance in your career, you want to stay as a special agent on a squad in cases, you could stay in an office like Buffalo your whole career.
Well, it's been very interesting talking to you. Kevin Lyons, acting special agent in charge of the FBI in Buffalo. Kevin, if I ever hear glass breaking at 3 a.m., I'm going to call you, okay?
Thank you, Sandy.
Thank you for coming by.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more. This is 12 Voices for 12 Hours on News Radio 930 WBEN.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.